From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Denise. Anti-stress. Because today we're talking about sort of a lifelong stressor for parents.
Yes.
For many parents.
And kids.
We're fortunate. We're going to be talking to the dean of admissions at Stanford. And it's not really about getting into Stanford, but I do have one story about getting into Stanford.
Okay.
So Ingram Olkin, God bless his soul, was a professor in the GSE. And in his final years, he was telling me how he was trying to donate his body when he passed away to the medical school, and they rejected him. And he said, "I can't even get into Stanford on my deathbed."
That's a great story. That's a great story. Well, I decided that it was time for me to stump you, Dan.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So Dan usually stumps me. I'm going to try to stump him today. We'll see how I do. I've got a couple questions about college admissions. First of all, how many students are enrolled in undergraduate education in the United States?
10 million.
That is how many were enrolled in the 1970s. 10 million. What is it today?
10 million.
No, Dan, that's what you just said. That was what it was in the 1970s, okay? It is double. I'm just going to tell you. It is double. Over 20 million college students enrolled undergraduate
wow.
right now, okay? So look at that jump from the 1970s to 2015.
Wow.
Okay, I knew that.
No, I'm just thinking of sales of Play-Doh have gone through the
just
roof.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Okay, here's another one. What percent of applicants turned in four or more applications to colleges? So they applied to four or more colleges or university. What percent of all the applicants who are applying?
Can I have a lifeline?
Okay, lifeline. What do you need?
When I take the SAT, don't I sort of get a certain number free to get sent out?
It's built into the price. Yes, yes.
How many?
I don't know. Three or four.
Then I would say 85%.
Oh, you're pretty good. Okay, so 80% did four or more applications in 2015.
Ooh.
But this may shock you. Seven or more applications. I don't know how many colleges you applied to when you were applying to college. Do you remember?
I do.
How many did you apply to?
One.
Okay.
And my parents wouldn't let me go to that one. So they applied me to another school.
I love that. My parents applied me to another school. Okay, well, I will tell you. Seven or more applications.
So that's complicated. It used to be sort of your top and then your safe school. So now it's like I've got five top schools, a medium school, and a safe school. Are these the categories that have evolved?
I don't think people are as thoughtful as that. I can tell you that part of this is because there's something called the Common App that got started. So it's a little bit easier just to push that button once you've got that.
I don't have like who's the person I respect the most for one college, and then another one's like,
yeah.
Which person do I wish I could have met?
Well, interestingly, so the Common Application has an essay or a choice of essays that you write, and you can – that's like your main essay, and you can turn that in with your application where you turn it in everywhere. But then any school that you're applying to has the right to ask for additional – it's called supplemental questions.
Mm-hmm.
And Stanford is one of them that has supplemental questions. So it's not as easy as just pushing a button, boom, 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 boom. So do you want me
this
to
is
tell
fun.
You?
Yeah, I'm one for two.
Okay, it's 30% of kids.
Apply to seven or more?
Seven or more. And I personally know kids who apply to 20.
And their hit rate is 5%? They
well,
only get
no, I mean, that's the thing. I know a kid who literally got into 15 out of 20, and they're only going to one school. So think of what that does to the system.
You mean to the poor staff that's reading?
Exactly. Yes, yes. And then they're admitting kids, and then they might say no, and then you got to go to your wait list. And it's a very complex thing.
Why do you apply to 20?
Out of the fear that you won't get into any. And so that's why I want to end with this one last
okay.
one, and then we're going to get to our guest. What percent in 2015 of kids attended their first or second choice college?
I would say it's pretty high. I think people probably slot it pretty well. So let's say two-thirds.
85% get into their first or second choice college. 94% get into one of their top three. And we got kids applying to 15, 20. It's a crazy thing. So we are super lucky to have such an expert here with us. Richard Shaw, Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid at Stanford, otherwise known as the man everybody wants as their best friend. Thank you for being here, Richard. Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
So, Rick, I'm going to call you Rick because we go back. What do you think of all these numbers? You've been in admissions for a long time. You've been at public universities, private universities. You've been doing this for a while. What do you think?
Let me start by first saying that I applied to six, and I had one top and one safety school and four in the middle. And that seemed to be a pretty good way to approach this process. And I've seen over time that, in fact, fear is a driver. And most students who are thinking about higher education really are not too sure if they're going to fare well in any of this process. It's unfortunate. And part of it is because the national press drives people's awareness of schools. So your other statistic was quite interesting, that many get into their first or second choice.
Yeah.
Because the press would make you believe it's impossible to get into college. And they focus on schools that are certainly the most competitive and most selective in the country. And I think for a lot of students, they become fearful that there might be a trickle-down effect, because if they apply to that other school, they don't get in, then they're going to go to the one I want to go to.
Right.
And so the reality is that they up the ante. And I have seen the same thing you have. In fact, when I was traveling with my own daughter to look at colleges, I remember sitting in a waiting room, and somebody asked the audience, how many schools did you apply to? And this student had been admitted to that school. And she stood up and said 17.
Yeah.
And she'd gotten into quite a number of them. So what happens is that every school has to admit to a number where they think they're going to be successful in enrolling the right number of students. And so there is a sort of a push-out effect in all of this, and many of the same kids getting into a whole bunch of schools. And so it does create some anxiety, and in some cases that means that schools that haven't met their enrollment goals are pushed down to the wait list. And I think, Denise, you are correct in saying the ease of application has changed all of this over the last couple of decades. That is, now everything's web-based, so you can apply pretty easily to almost anywhere in the world. And that's true internationally as well. So many of us see applications increasing from every constituent group, although certainly the student has to take on some challenge as it relates to applying to places like Stanford, because you have to answer a lot of questions. But they do that. So we're seeing a ballooning of demand, and I think a lot of students that, at least on the front end, don't believe that they might be successful.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're speaking with Rick Shaw, Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid at Stanford. And I know that those applications to Stanford go up every year. The more and more kids want to go. I know it's a good thing we have more kids than ever going to college these days, but we have only increased our incoming class by, 100 over the time that you've been here? How many slots?
Good question. We really have not increased it much of any over a period of time. Maybe 50 spaces over at least 10 or even more years. And that's a challenge.
Although the graduate enrollment in graduate has gone up quite a bit at Stanford.
Graduate students, yeah.
I'm speaking only about the undergraduate environment, and that's right. Demand for graduate programs has gone up as well, and actually space for graduate students. It's an important issue for Stanford. It's an important issue for a lot of places.
Yeah.
We anticipate we're going to see some growth of that number in the future. Right now, in the midst of a strategic plan in which we can hopefully increase the size of the class. Not there yet, but obviously not increasing the size and seeing more applicants has an impact.
I want to return to the sort of the fear, and your proposition is the media make it seem that way because they focus on the elite. But, you know, I do think universities contribute. There is a lack of transparency on whether I'll get in. So I have a colleague at a public university where they do the salary setting very specifically. So if you get a journal article published, you get like 3 points.
A book chapter, if you're a professor.
If you're a professor, you get, if you do a book chapter, you get 1 point. If you're on a national panel, you get 20 points, which so only the very senior faculty get that. And then they add these up and they use that algorithmically to decide what is your salary. So that it's bad, but it's incredibly transparent. The lack of transparency means I don't really know whether I'm going to get in or not. And so, of course, I'm going to apply to a lot of places. And I don't, it's not the media that's doing that. It's the ambiguity. And so why do we do that? Why don't we just say, if you cross this line, you're in?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I used to work at a public university in which there was a formula. And the formula did exactly what you suggest, said, if you meet these conditions, you are eligible for this system, and we guarantee you'll be admitted. Public system, and formula-driven, test scores, grades, not a lot of flexibility in terms of looking at other characteristics. We don't mean not to be transparent, but it's really important to emphasize that we care about every characteristic of the candidate who's applying to the university. And we approach this by doing what we call holistic admissions, in which we look at autobiography. We look at not just the academic record or the courses they've taken or test scores, but we actually look at the student's personal, or listen to the personal voice. We look at the things they've done outside the classroom. We look at their hopes and aspirations, their dreams about what they'd like to do. And because of that, I can't build that into a formula. I can't make a formula out of something like that. I can tell you that we take all of those sorts of things into account. We're not trying to stress out the student by doing that, but we do want to hear, we want to hear their perspective and their voice. And to be honest, among those students that apply to our institution, well above 80% are highly qualified and competitive for a position in the class, 80% of the applicants. And so we find ourselves in a very selective environment where we're trying to make very hard decisions and establish a match between those that we finally offer a position to and those that we that we don't. Now, the reality is many of the students, vast majority of the students who are highly qualified and competitive don't get in. And so our approach is one in which we really take into account the human aspects of the candidates and all of the things they've done.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking today with Rick Shaw, Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid at Stanford, really talking about the fact that you're doing holistic review, that 80% who apply to Stanford are qualified. We take less than 5%. That sounds scary on the one hand. On the other hand, the good news is that for the first time, we have the largest group of first generation to go to college students accepted here. Can you talk a little bit about that? I was so excited to hear that.
The reality is that one of the founding principles at Stanford from its very beginning was that it wanted to be a university that would be open and accessible to all people, men and women from all walks of life. That sounds a little bit silly today because of the demand, but the reality is we are open and accessible to all students from all walks of life. So we really go about reviewing our candidates in the context of each individual's, in the context of where they live and learn, that individual student. So we're, no matter what we do, there's no favored nation status. There's no feeder high schools or preference for any part of the world or preference for any part of the country. We go right to that kid's home environment, their school, their experience, and we look at how they've succeeded in terms of the resources they have available to them when applying to college. Many of the students that are interested in Stanford, and we have a major commitment to them, are first-generation, low-income kids who, in many cases, in years past, wouldn't apply to a place like Stanford. But now they realize that, in fact, they have a shot at being students here, and they've chosen to apply. And we look, again, holistically at the application. They're very competitive, along with the other many students that are competitive and very deserving, and actually the best of the best in the context of where they've lived and learned. And so we're very fortunate to have been, over time, growing the interest on the part of low-income students. And we are committed to one of our own faculty members, Raj Chetty, has taken a hard look at selective higher education, and we're interested in mobility. That is, young people who are perhaps don't have parents who have gone to college or graduated from a four-year institution, having the opportunity to come in a place like this and then move on to graduate and have lots of options for the life that they live.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that with that comes financial aid, that you are committed to these students monetarily as well as giving them the support they need when they're here. And a lot of institutions are doing this. We're seeing more do this. So for those folks out there who wouldn't think that this is a place that they could ever go to, I think that that would be important.
Right. I think a lot of people actually, first-generation kids historically have said, they see the price or their parents see the price and they go, we can't go there.
Right.
So they don't even apply. And in fact, the truth is that they can go to Stanford in most cases with just a very small contribution that the student makes by doing some work while they're going to school, but a very small contribution. Most of it, room and board, tuition and fees, tuition is paid for by the university and they don't have to repay it. That's an important message. That's one of the great challenges for first-gen low-income kids, though, nationally. You have to take a close look at where affordability plays a role. And, of course, that's in most places. But, in fact, you might be eligible and competitive for a highly selective university, and you don't simply have to go to the one that's in your hometown.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will have more with Rick Shaw, Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid at Stanford, next on SiriusXM Insight 121.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking today with Rick Shaw, Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid at Stanford University.
So I want to go back to this question of how we decide admissions and how, in general, Stanford, but everywhere else. And so I'm going to back into it a little bit. So there's a story that the taste tester for Campbell's Soup was dying. And this was the guy whose taste determined what all Campbell's Soups tasted like. Some signature quality that only he could taste. Before they died, they spent a lot of time trying to do what's called knowledge engineering. What is it that this guy's tasting so we can re-implement that? I sort of get that feeling here, right, that when Rick Shaw decides to retire, nobody else is going to have his same taste on who gets admitted, and it's going to be hard to keep it going forward because it's a certain je ne sais quoi. And I'm not sure that's the case. In some ways, I'm thinking a certain lack of transparency about admissions is good. And for two reasons. One, it allows you flexibility to say, we're going to try and make this kind of community now and see if we can nudge society by who we admit. The other is, if we told you exactly what the rules were, you would just continually train your child just for those rules.
Yep.
Yeah, I thought you might like that one. So help me understand again, because I'm a parent, I got a kid, I want him to get into Yale, for example. We never talk about Yale, so I thought, say Yale. And they won't tell me exactly what I need. Damn it!
Right. So. Well, yeah, and I, by the way, was the dean of admissions at Yale, too.
I thought that's why you said it, Dan.
So I can...
I looked over at Rick like, oh,
I'm thinking, boy, and then when I quit tasting the soup there, I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
I probably went down...
It just fell apart.
I think one of the most important parts of this across the nation and by college and university is that the admissions office does not drive the decisions, the university does. So I have a faculty committee and instruction from the faculty that tells me what it is that we should that we should value in this process. So if I'm gone tomorrow, it will continue very effectively to do the important work that it does.
The Stanford soup will taste the same.
That it should taste the same. I want to emphasize the fact that it really is important for students to be successful in school. The common denominator across the nation is that you go to school, you work hard, you do well, in your courses. You know, you're preparing for college, so some sense of what the expectations are. And that also that you don't only just go to school to regurgitate what you learn, but those students that emerge in this process across the nation and in lots of committee rooms around the nation are kids who actually have embraced their secondary education in a way in which you have a sense of their love for what they do, whatever that might be. It might be academic, it might be extracurricular. But they approach the process by not being formulaic, not being controlled by others, but in fact finding a place within their secondary experience in which they experience love of doing drama, love of the orchestra, love of the respective coursework they're in. And in a lot of ways, these schools are looking for the energy and the innovation and the excitement that kids have about not only what they've been through, and I know this is driven impacted by the fact they feel so much stress, which mm-hmm. is unfortunate, but also what they the potential that they have to do, what they can do in higher education as well. And so there is no formula, but there is a sense of in our review process across the nation in small colleges, large colleges, public universities. That we're looking for young people who will be a good match for our institutions. And it might be here, it might be somewhere else. To be honest with you, you would say, well, what was the paradigm difference between Yale and Stanford? And the fact is we really looked for the same things, which was this energy and this and the potential. So a lot of cases, it's the first generation kid who hasn't had any resources, but you see the glimmer, you see the grit, you see the possibilities of that young person, and you realize that if they have the resources in college, they'll take it the distance. And I think that's what happens.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are speaking with Rick Shaw, Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid at Stanford. And I've got a question, Rick. We're hearing a lot about sort of the college admission process changing. There's some organizations out there that are trying to make changes in college admission. I know my own organization, we're trying to tamp down on the stress around college admissions. Where do you see college admissions going? Do you see the changes happening?
Yeah, this is the toughest question because you know, and in your organization and others do, caring matters, things like that, that there's concern that there's too much pressure on young people in school. That is, they're forced to take instead of some APs, they take 10 APs or whatever the case may be, and they're not, in fact, having an opportunity to embrace the secondary experience in a way which would reflect what I said a minute ago, which is the love of learning and the love of the experience. The difficulty in all of this is that we have a lot of applicants to our institutions, and kids are approaching this and coming from. They aren't all the same. We're assuming everybody is the same in applying, and the kids are in different places in terms of their secondary experience and the courses they take and what they think they want to take. But I would say that we don't really spend a lot of time counting advanced placement courses. We really, again, are coming back to look at the kid. We do want them to challenge themselves, but we know that in some cases it may not be appropriate for them to do, you know, all of these things, because that's not where their aptitude is. So there's a myth, I think, to some extent, that we only count all of these things, and those are only the kids that get in. And in fact, it isn't just about the courses or the grades or the scores. It's also about the human being behind all of it. And so we're reading for that. We understand that we don't want to drive kids to distraction before they get to college. And in fact, what we're finding in higher education is a lot of students are arriving and then seeking out counseling.
Yeah.
Because they arrive being relatively stressed out. And we certainly don't want to contribute to that. And we've been given the moniker that we do. And I don't think that's what our intent is.
I don't think it's intentional. I think it's the nature of it. When in our studies, when we ask kids the top source of stress in their life, they could say anything: alcoholic parent, boyfriend broke up with them. Sometimes up to 30% say the top source of stress is getting into college. So if you're constantly living your life for that future, which you feel you don't have control over. So here's the thing that I want folks to know, and Rick, I've heard you can back me up on this. There are over 4,000 accredited universities in the United States. Over 4,000. There's almost 3,000 that are four-year colleges in the United States. 3,000, not 13, not the whatever, however, Ivies plus Stanford plus MIT. You just said 80% are qualified. Those kids are going to go to great schools. Yeah. So you're going to have great peers anywhere you go.
Right. I think it's really unfortunate that, again, press drives the top 20 or 50 or whatever the case may be, and that drives people's towards where they think they should apply, even though they may not know a lot about those institutions. At the end of every cycle, I get phone calls.
I'm sure you do.
And often from parents. In fact, mostly from parents who love their children and care deeply about their future, and they are perplexed. But the first thing I do, because their son or daughter didn't get in, and the first thing I do when I answer the phone and they begin the conversation is, where did she get in? And then they tell me, and I say, no, really, seriously, where did she get in? And they tell me the school, and I say, this is an incredible day. This is a wonderful day to celebrate. You must be so excited about this. Because, in fact, there are all of these opportunities, all of these places, all of these amazing colleges and universities that young people can go to. And we know, even from our position, that they will get into many of them. I think the kids understand that, too, a little bit better. I think they're more resilient. I think the families need to chill out.
You heard it here. Chill out about college admissions.
Chill out.
Thank you for being here, Rick, and thank you, listeners, for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app.